let's talk about the other side of the coin, and let's talk about rheumatoid arthritis, because I think that the step trial, as we said, has been out a while. It's helpful as the sort of prime, you know, the original, but we've seen data now in rheumatoid arthritis, somewhat hypothesis generating, but interesting. So I saw there was a study in 2025 in ACR Open from Kellner et al, looking at RA patients with who were receiving GLP-1 agonists compared to controls. So they had 173 patients. They had 42 controls who basically compared disease activity, pain scores, and by biomarker data, general lab data, and this sort of retrospective study showed good reduction in disease activity in those on GLP-1s. It showed reduction in pain scores. It showed improvements in ESR, CRP. I've also got the data here. HbA1c, which is perhaps not that impressive or surprising really in this case. Lipid profiles, again, great, welcome, fantastic, but perhaps not surprising. Improvements in weight, as you might expect. They didn't actually, in this case, note that, well, they didn't find that weight loss correlated with improvements in inflammatory markers, which is interesting, given what we've said previously. Did correlate with metabolic improvements. You would expect that, as you're saying. This is a drug initially developed for type 2 diabetes, 2005, the first one. So, you know, we would expect at this point to see that sort of improvement. So it's difficult to sort of really...
And this is observational data.
This is retrospective cohort.
So this
is a retrospective. So all of the usual real-world data caveats, you know, apply. It's difficult to draw too many conclusions. It's interesting. Decent numbers, you know, 173 people with RA, 42 controls. So it's not too, you know, 42 controls who didn't get therapy. So that is interesting. And it's this question, as you say, of like, you know, is this reduction in weight driving a reduction in adipose tissue-driven cytokine production and pro-inflammatory mediator production? And also the question that we raised earlier, you know, is immunomodulation occurring at a systemic level or even primarily at the synovial tissue? We know, as you said, that these GLP-1 receptors exist in the synovial tissue and indeed in multiple other tissues within the body. But to what extent modulation of these is driving reduction in inflammation? So it's tricky. And then, of course, there's the data in psoriatic arthritis as well.
Of course there is.
Psoriatic arthritis.
There's much more exciting data than in RA now. because Together PSA was a press release was released recently. And that is first of its kind study comparing ixekizumab with the tirzepatide compared to ixekizumab on its own. I have a slight... I don't know, I want to hear your thoughts about this study's primary endpoint, why I choose that. And the primary endpoint was ACR50 response in PSA activity and more than 10% weight reduction. Mm-hmm. And this is between groups, what takes ixekizumab alone and group what takes ixekizumab with tirzepatide. So I'm like, always like... This is a very interesting choice of primary endpoint, isn't it? No surprise it was met by a significant margin. In the combined group, it was 31.1% which achieved it. And in the ixekizumab group, it was only 0.8%. I assume predominantly because of not achieving the weight loss part of the endpoint.
It's interesting. I have to caveat this with that I haven't dug into the data in a sort of deep way. So
we don't have a data. It's just a press release.
But it is interesting, isn't it? ACR50 is well.
But I think probably the headlines are not going to be made by the primary endpoint, but it's going to be by the secondary endpoint by looking at whether there is superiority in the combined therapy or ixekizumab alone achieving ACR50. not taking weight loss now into account. And actually, there is significant superiority in a combined group. It was achieved. The ACR50 was achieved in 33.5, and in ixekizumab alone, 20.4%. So kind of 64% relative increase. So this, from the data what we have so far, it is suggesting that there is this super added effect to the weight loss medications, to the IL-17 blockade, of controlling PSA activity.
Mm. I mean, I think it's the strongest signal that we have, isn't it, really, in rheumatology for the, as you say, the effect of adipose tissue and that driving disease activity. But it's interesting.
It will be interesting to see more when the data is published, what disease outcomes they have used, and about patient reported outcomes, just thinking about functionality, about the pain, and how much there's differences between those two groups. But I think as a study, it's brilliant, and just I think that's really what we kind of in rheumatology we will need. We can know these drugs help to lose significant amount of weight. The question is, how much added effect in addition to already even modulator drugs what we use, they have. That will be the key thing what we will have to answer to justify the use for them to control disease activity, plus in improve functionality of patients and symptom control.
And you would imagine with that degree of weight loss that you would see improvements in patient-reported outcome measures and functionality, irrespective of whether it was driving a reduction in an inflammatory component. You know, it's hard to conceive of people losing that amount of weight and not seeing some improvement in functional scores. So it's always going to be difficult to tease out, isn't it? But it's very interesting stuff. And I think these psoriatic disease patients are often the patients that we are chasing improvements in disease activity, and maybe we have been chasing, you know, maybe we've been barking up the wrong tree, and maybe improving weight here is really, like, because it's I suppose it's a bit like having a rattle in the car, you know, and just turning the radio up, and actually you want to address, you know, the price if we feel that if we feel that adipose tissue is a central part of this process, then failing to address it, or indeed giving medications that maybe may make it a bit worse, like steroids, maybe that isn't the best way to go about it. So I suppose that you know, is interesting.
Yeah, and what we know for PSA and psoriasis is that some might argue that obesity and increase of weight comes after they have developed disease due to the functional impairment, what's active joint inflammation causes, reducing activities. But we have strong data showing that it is not the case. Obesity precedes PSA and skin psoriasis diagnosis, so they're not consequence. It's they exist parallel and has inter.
I think there's got to be some additive effect of the sort of functional impairment that you see, and therefore trying to then lose weight at that point is obviously trickier. But yeah, it's interesting to see that it obviously predates it. I think if you're going to talk about PSA, then I'm going to talk about lupus, even if it's not directly related to it.
Try to surprise me. I doubt you have as good kind of brilliant.
I don't think I have the data on lupus to back this up, but I will sort of talk about it. I mean, there have been a few sort of case reports, sort of rare case reports in these GLP-1s of drug-induced lupus. I think it's pretty low-level evidence at this point in time. Be interesting to see what comes out. Somebody has done a small sort of retrospective case series in lupus, and they found some interesting things. So they didn't find any excess flare signal, which is really reassuring. Very minimal flares over 8 months. 13% in this case, there is BMI reduction, which is good. No new classification criteria met over the course of it. So I think the effort for worsening of disease flare is weak in lupus. The thing that I think is interesting in lupus, it's an exciting time to be working at. Obviously, many different pathways being opened up, many different therapeutics. But one of the biggest killers is still accelerated cardiovascular disease that we see. And I'm talking about that through the lens of lupus, but it's probably, you know, it's equally true in inflammatory disease generally. So I suppose we've talked about where GLPs came, you know, GLP-1, where they started. We've talked about them in osteoarthritis, which may be inflammatory. We've spoken about them in inflammatory arthritis and you know, their potentially disease modifying aspects. But the other aspect of this and the other side of it is to say we have a collection of diseases that are all associated with worsening of cardiovascular outcomes, which are massive population level killers. And
that's the number one cause for mortality, isn't it, for people with autoimmune diseases?
Exactly. So even if we were to take out the idea that these are disease modifying at that level, there is a discussion to be had about how effective they are reducing cardiovascular outcomes and whether that is something that we personally need to be involved in the management of, or whether that is still something that actually is managed in other specialties and we're stepping outside of our comfort zone. And it's interesting looking at some of the sort of real world data on it. And it's what you would expect, but it's helpful to see it in real world data. You know, you're seeing a reduced rate of acute coronary syndrome risk in RA cohorts, and that includes those on JAK inhibition. Yeah. That's interesting. You know, we're seeing it even in those patients. We're seeing, as I said, you know, lower rates of adverse cardiovascular events in lupus and lupus nephritis patients, and we're seeing reduced progression to CKD generally as well. So, you know, irrespective of how you feel about them as disease modifiers, you know, they are probably going to have some mortality benefit in our patients, and we do need to facilitate people guessing them if they, well, my feeling is that if in those for whom they are appropriate, I think we need to try and facilitate them being treated.
And I think in recent years we have been paying much more attention how we can modify cardiovascular risk factors for our patients. What we know are much more higher compared to the healthy population, and beyond statins and blood pressure control, this seems to be a class of drug what could have a significant impact in that, isn't it?
Yeah, and we're used to getting excited about reductions in, you know, PASIs and reductions, you know, like small incremental, although, you know, significant incremental improvements in DAS28 score, you know, PASI scores, WOMAC pain scores and things like that, which are all very important in themselves. But we're talking about drugs now that are actually improving mortality. And big reductions in potentially massive reductions in cardiovascular mortality. So this is really, you know, going to be central and something that's just going to have to be addressed, at a population-wide level, but also within rheumatology. I think we're going to, it's only going to expand in terms of its application, really. So it's interesting.
It just, for me personally, it just feels a shame that we know that these drugs can do this. They're doing that outside rheumatology patients, outside autoimmune diseases. But we will need to go through the process of research or having a data, what supports their use and the same effect for our patients. It just feels a shame, and I know we need a data, we need a strong evidence base to support this, but it just will take so much time, I feel, before we get there. And I think what probably will help is how widely they are accessible for patients. Obviously, different healthcare systems are around the world will have a different systems in place, but actually there is a possibility for patients to pay for them themselves, but I think that will be interesting how we as a clinicians are going to navigate that with this limited evidence data what we have at the moment. How do we make these conscious decisions and are able to guide the patients to making these choices?
And it depends. Obviously, that will vary massively where you work. Obviously, you and I both work in the UK, so this will be a sort of NHS wide decision. We are seeing people. I mean, there's a massive proportion of people who are sourcing these drugs privately via private prescriptions already. This question for the NHS sort of population level, for those working in other healthcare, sectors and other parts of the world, it will differ. So it will do, both access to therapies, cost of therapies, and, insurer payouts and reimbursement will vary between places. So it will be a very different landscape depending on where you're working globally. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of those medications where sadly we will see disparities, I think, or quite significant disparities on a global level with these things, just intrinsically. So it's interesting, really. So I suppose there's a few sort of questions raised from it. I mean, we've spoken an awful lot about, the potential illogical activity of these medications. And I suppose one of the questions I'd say to you as somebody working more commonly in psoriatic arthritis, seeing more psoriatic arthritis patients than me, is if you had access, and we've spoken about that trial, your ixekizumab trial, and if you had access to these therapies now, would you preferentially give incretin-based therapy, so GLP-1, agonist to your patients? I mean, it's difficult. Or do you think the data is not there? Or where are you with it?
I don't think how confident I feel starting to manage weight. So we are stepping, as a rheumatologist, we are stepping outside of area of expertise quite significantly in weight management. But we're not really used to at all. And if it would be just straightforward, you take this medication, you lose weight, everything is perfect, then it probably be fine, isn't it? Yeah, there's nothing really that you need to do. But it's not, the story is not that simple, isn't it? We know that losing weight, you not only lose the fat mass, but you lose the muscle mass as well. Yeah. And this very rapid loss of weight goes alongside with the rapid loss of muscle mass. And the strategies, how they are used, we have increasing evidence that on its own, these drugs are not good enough, because once you stop them, you regain weight, and you can regain weight quite rapidly. And most of the weight what you put back is pure fat, because you can't generate new muscle that quickly. So using these drugs, you have to do something alongside to keep them. The loss of muscle mass will eventually happen, because you can't lose that amount of weight not losing muscle mass. But how can you reduce the loss of muscle mass as minimal as possible and maintain that? So that involves strength, resistance training, and how do we do that? Is that our kind of, what advice do we give? What kind of facilities do we have to support these patients? And although ultimately it will come to the patient's choice, what do they do? But what advice do we give? Do we have a ways to refer these patients to have access to the strength training, to the resistance training, to think about diet? Because ultimately how these drugs work, they reduce satiety, and that's it, they eat less, they are in the calorie deficit being in a calorie excess before. So there's kind of dietary advice as well. Probably you need to change diet. It has to be more protein-rich diet, what you have before to keep the muscle mass. So there is additional things what using the therapy have to be done to keep the muscle. And I'm not sure if I would be able to advise that at the moment, and if I have facilities around me to help to give patients that type of advice and recommendation and for them to access help in that sense.
I think that's critical, isn't it? It's critical. It's, you know, it's a sort of loaded question me asking that, really, I suppose. But you know, these are powerful drugs that we're seeing massively. You know, we're seeing very, very, very good effects with them, but they have to be used in the context of all of the things you just said. You know, we have to encourage patients to stay physically active for reasons above and beyond purely. The skeletal muscle mass, you know, is extremely important, but, you know, even above and beyond that, it is something we should be encouraging. We need to anyway. Diet and, you know, dietary modification and sort of long-term dietary planning, because as we see, we have seen, you know, patients regaining weight on these when they come off. That being said, it's timely that we talk about this because of the bimagrumab data that came out very recently. So that is an adjunctive treatment given alongside semaglutide. And the aim of that was to reduce the loss of lean muscle mass, and there were quite encouraging results in that data. So it may be that medications, you know, improvements in this, we're talking about triple agonists that are going to come out at some point in the future, oral therapies as well on the way. It may be that they address some of these concerns pharmacologically, but I like you, I'm very, very strongly of the opinion that this has to be a package. It has to come with the physical activity, the lifestyle change, and there's some long-term adjustments, because we can't, there's no panacea to this, although it might seem so, you know, at this point in time. I think
we have to remember that probably the average patient, our patients with inflammatory joint disease, who will be using this treatment, will be different from the average patient who has been using them so far, just purely for the weight loss, or if someone who has diabetes, because we have taken into account advanced joint disease. We have taken into account active inflammatory disease causing disability and functional restrictions and pain, what is causing. So all these factors will have to be taken into account. What actually this the patient is able to do, are they able to do, go to the gym and do strength work, or that has to be some chair-based or very, very low impact one, and how effective that will actually be. And someone who has advanced degenerative joint disease, what they are able to do in addition to use these drugs to keep the muscle mass on. And I think as a rheumatologist, we'll have to play the key role in that, because we know what limitations they will have and what can be done. So I think we will have to be involved in the care, but whether us lonely, solely managing that is the answer, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah. I suppose it is. I mean, in the UK, it is going back to our roots of, you know, because originally we were rehabilitative medics primarily, and then we had the biologic and the DMARD revolution, and we moved into the sort of, you know, moved away from that, so maybe this is a sort of return to form initially, but I agree it has to be.
I hope not, but
that's for sure. But yes, we're gonna have to have it, and I am more comfortable. I suppose to answer my own question, really, I would be happy to prescribe them, but I would, like you, I don't think we're that far away from each other in terms of how we feel. I would feel that they need additional support beyond what I can provide. So services are going to have to change to accommodate that. I think we will be prescribing them. is Masata, but I think that there will be development of services that spring up in order to address that need, because there's plenty of gaps and unknown unknowns that I wouldn't want to.
You're very positive.
I'm being positive. I'm trying to avoid being cavalier. So I think somebody will need to hold my hand through aspects of it, but I'm more than happy to to trial it. So I suppose it's probably a good time to sort of wrap up, really. I mean, I might spring that on you, Rihaz, to discuss where we are with things. But
so I think we are very early days in rheumatology with these drugs. There is a lot of noise. Everyone is talking about this and what it can do for our patients. Much more evidence is needed to be much more better understanding about incretin effects beyond weight loss is needed. And I think that evidence will be just coming out very rapidly year by year. But I think, like you said, services are going to develop and change alongside with that. I think this is not be the case where we're going to wait for strong evidence, good quality RTC data before we start to use them. Although maybe policymaking that will influence our patients already are taking them. I think I actively ask about it. I always, when I see patient, I ask them if they take it, and some people say that's themselves. And I still don't know how I feel about recommending it. That's a different question. What we kind of discussed already, but I think it's a fast moving field, and we just need to keep an eye on the latest developments, and I'm sure the upcoming international conferences will be full with more data on this.
Yeah, and I'd say, just to sort of move on from that, so in talking about large international conferences or even slightly smaller international conferences that I was at recently, so that's probably about it for this session. But I think next month we'll be talking about Sjögren's, and there will be some insights from the recent SLE Euro conference. So we'll be discussing some of the big outputs from that. So hopefully see you soon.
Yeah, exciting.
See you next time.
Thank you. See you. Bye-bye.